This is the town and these are the people. This is the town where the people all stay. This is the town and these are the people. That's the way they wanted it. That's the way it's going to stay.
Greetings, folks. This is Vince. You're listening to The Point. I'm going to do a quick set of announcements right now before we get into the main part of the show. I think it may take up close to, if not up, the whole time, the whole hour and a half block. It is a meeting that was sponsored by the Susquehanna County Rescue Group. Rescue hosted a meeting at the Forest City High School Auditorium on Wednesday the 16th, 7 p.m., and invited two Department of Environmental Protection of Pennsylvania officials, along with a Pennsylvania State Cooperative Extension researcher, to come and talk about water safety, drilling safety, and then answer questions from the public. Announcements. Also, I want to, this has probably already been in the news, but I want to kind of set this as a backdrop for what I'm about to play with the DEP meeting, is the latest chemical spill in Dimock, Pennsylvania. It's been reported between 8,000 and 9,000 gallons of a hydrofracturing gel, a chemical used to help get the gas out of the ground, was leaked or had spilled into the ground in Dimock, Pennsylvania. This came about 2 days after the meeting at Forest City. I won't speak for any of the people that you're about to hear. I just want you to know that as they're talking to you, to let you know that 2 days later there was an 8,000 to 9,000 gallon spill of chemicals that happened in Dimock, and this was a one in a string of many diesel spills and chemical spills and methane getting into the groundwater and into people's homes. So just so you have a bit of an understanding of what's going on in this local area and being able to compare that with what is being told to you by public officials and people that are considered knowledgeable in these matters. First, also to introduce you to the speakers, I will let you know who's speaking later, but just let you know the first DEP official, Mr. Craig Lobbins, Northwest Regional Manager for the Oil and Gas Program. Mr. Lobbins' office is in Meadville and is responsible for issuing the gas drilling permits for 27 counties, the entire northern half of Pennsylvania, including Susquehanna and Wayne counties. The other DEP official is Ms. Jennifer Means. She is the regional manager of the North Central Office for Oil and Gas Management, located in Williamsport. The Williamsport office is responsible for the monitoring and compliance of the gas wells, including the inspections. Her department also has a role in reviewing and approving water withdrawals from Marcellus Shale development. Mr. Lobbins and Ms. Means are the principal government officials we have for protecting the water quality in the northern Pennsylvania, and especially relating to the gas and drilling industry. The third speaker is Brian Swistock, and he's a water resource extension specialist for the Penn State Cooperative Extension. Mr. Swistock performs research in the School of Forest Resources at Penn State University. He has conducted research and extension programs on water resources issues related to drinking water, lake and watershed management, water conservation, climate change, and land use impacts. Again, I will let you know who is speaking after you hear their voice, so that you can later on understand who is saying what and being able to associate who they are to the kind of questions that they're answering. So I guess that's all the announcements I have relating to that. I will have some more announcements at the top of the hour, but for right now, let's get started on this interview. We'll pull that up right now, and I will So this is the DEP and one member of the Penn State Cooperative Extension answering questions to the public at the Forest City High School on Wednesday, September 16th, about water safety, drilling safety, and many issues relating to the Marcellus Shale hydrofracturing process. So here we go.
And my question for the two folks from the DEP, and either one or both of you can answer this, and I'd ask you to answer it as candidly as you possibly can. Based on the fact that, one, you're trying to staff up to handle this activity, and the fact that this activity is increasing at a rather significant rate, scale of 0 to 10, 0 being not confident, 10 very confident. How confident are you that the staffing that you presently have is going to adequately handle enforcement issues for all this stuff that's going on in northeastern PA?
I think it's a staffing question. I think right now it's a very good start. We essentially, I think everyone realizes what's going on across the state as far as the budget. We don't even have a budget signed yet and stuff, but this is the first phase. We added 37 positions, and our plan is to add more positions. So we just, so I think at a scale 1 to 5, I think we're about at a 5, but I think everyone can see that there is going to be continual growth out in this area. So I think the state actually has plans on adding more staff. We did a workload analysis, and that's part of our projections, and this was the first phase of it. So scale 1 to, I'd say 5.
Okay, and who you just heard there was Craig Lobbins. I will try not to interrupt too much like this in the future. I just wanted to get you. He'll be the main speaker throughout most. Sorry about that. He'll be the main speaker throughout most of what's going on here and all the questions answered. So just to give you kind of a backdrop as to what is. Just to give you a backdrop of who he was saying. I also wanted to bring up and make mention of this one point of he was mentioning the what he feels like his division of the DEP and how they are, how staffed they are, and he mentions a 5 out of 10. Just want you to keep that in mind as you're listening more and you're hearing other questions and you're hearing the answers as to how Mr. Lobbins feels his department is staffed and how they are ready to handle this drilling industry. So I will continue with the interview, and I'll be interrupting after certain questions just so I can discuss what is going on and perhaps offer some insight into what is happening here, but so here we go.
If the municipal water suppliers and others get special permits that allow them to do that, and a homeowner can only really sell access to water, technically speaking. You don't own that water, but there are special permits like the communities have to sell water to their customers that do allow them to sell it.
And what recourse do residents have? If they, I don't think this would apply to my place, it's up on the mountain, but people who live in neighborhoods where there's an awful lot of criminal activity, like Chem Lawn and Sears Lawn and Green Thumb and all that stuff on everybody's lawn, that's got to get into a well someplace. Creeks.
No, I wouldn't say it happened. It does happen occasionally. The thing to remember about, for example, Chem Lawn and a lot of that stuff gets bound up very quickly. So the real problem with that is if it's applied right around a water supply, again, within that very small area, it's much less likely that it's going to make it through all the soil and rock.
Like on a lakefront property or something, I would think.
Lakefronts are a bigger problem with a lot of applications of herbicides and fertilizers. Those are bigger problems. And we do a lot of talks for lake community associations about reducing that to try to cut down on plant algae growth in their lakes.
It's not illegal at this point.
No.
So, thank you.
Okay. And who you just heard there was Brian Swistock. And I'm sorry for the confusion and the lack of coordination here. I'm trying to run this program for the first time, and I'm having a little bit of trouble syncing up where I want the cursor to be over the sound, but I have it all figured out now, so you won't. The first part of that question was the man asking about ownership of water, and that was Brian Swistock answering that citizens and taxpayers do not have any ownership over their water, and then the man was going into talking about if they don't have ownership over the water, what recourse would they have if their water becomes poisoned, let's say by Chemlon or some herbicide or those lawn treatment little flags and groups that you see in the neighborhood. This is an important point to also remember later on when we're talking about water supplies and talking about poisoned water, is that the citizens of Pennsylvania, I can't say how it is in New York, but the citizens of Pennsylvania in this particular instance don't have any ownership over their own water, and so they don't have any legal recourse because they don't own the water that's being tainted. So this will become more of an issue later on as more questions are asked. But to keep that in mind as to what is available for the citizens should their water get tainted. And that's going to be an important question. So we'll continue on here.
My question is for Jennifer. Before I came, I read this article in the New York Times. Did you see it? This on Sunday? Well, which kind of compared environmental protection agencies in the different states identifying facilities which were out of compliance and whether any prosecution or whatever you call it took place. And I noticed that you said you were responsible for both of those things. But in this article, just for your information, Pennsylvania came out very poorly, indicating that they have 4,355 regulated facilities. 392 of them are out of compliance, and 20 of them had enforcement actions taken. So I just really wanted to know do you feel like you can enforce these things?
I guess it's kind of hard to address that a little bit because I'm not sure what type of facilities they're talking about there. I mean, I know our field staff go out to inspect well sites every day and, you know, regularly document violations at these well sites, and we regularly send what we call our notices of violations to these companies and, you know, tell them what they need to do to correct the problem, and what comes after that is assessments of penalties and that sort of thing. So we're in the process of a number of those right now. Since our office just kind of started this spring, you know, it kind of takes a few months to get that going, but I think it's a routine part of what we do. So those
assessing
numbers,
penalties is a routine part.
Yeah, I mean, taking enforcement actions, assessing penalties, if necessary, issuing orders to companies. I'm talking, you know, generally, not just well sites, but to take corrective action on whatever they need to do. That's a routine part of what we do. So I'm not really sure that those numbers make sense.
Do you have anything you want to say there?
Yeah.
Just an example. Our office probably issues about $400,000 of civil penalties a year. When I say our office, oil and gas issues about $400,000 of civil penalties a year. And just in July, we issued a cease and desist order to a company because they were just trying to do too much too fast and to get too many violations. So we actually stopped their business for about 2 months period until they got everything all buttoned up again, everything under control, and then they're allowed to operate again. And actually, that company had a 200-week assessed a $200,000 penalty for them. They're operating under McKean and Warren County. So we do take enforcement action. U.S. Energy. Yeah, that's no secret. U.S. Energy Corporation.
My question.
Okay, and so you just heard the last person yet to speak was Jennifer Means, Ms. Jennifer Means, and then followed by Mr. Craig Lobbins. And this is an important question relating to water and relating to the fines in general. Mr. Lobbins stated that they expect at any given year to get $400,000 to $500,000 in fines. And Ms. Means also noted that there is an intermediate step between getting fined where the company is given a warning or a citation where they're basically written up by the DEP and told to fix what they are doing wrong. This is important to understand the ideas behind this as far as these companies, Cabot Oil, U.S. Energy, make billions every year, and it is seems to be a problem to myself and to many other people that they are allowed to work and act in a very unsafe and hurried manner, which leads to many mistakes, and which by cutting corners and doing things not as they should be, there's an increased chance of screwing up and of spills and mistakes and everything associated with that. And to only charge $400,000 to $500,000 total for all the mistakes in one given year would mean that individual companies on individual incidents are paying pennies compared to the profit that they're making on a yearly basis, or even on a daily basis for that matter. So it's important to see how the taxpayer, not only are they affected by the spill that's happening in their backyard or across the street from them, but also their tax dollars are going to clean it up when the company should be responsible for cleaning up its own mess. So I think that should be noted, and we'll get on with the interview here.
Is a follow-on to the previous questioner about the New York Times article. On their website, you can look at the number of violations by state of the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. And I looked on their website for Pennsylvania, and it listed 9,408 violations of both those acts. They list the violations, the violators by name, starting with Allegheny Ludlam Corp. and 449 violations. It goes down from there. But what was interesting is that it shows the amount fined for these 408 violations, and the amount is zero for the entire state between 2004 and 2007. Do you have any explanation of this? And can you give us some confidence that your enforcement will be more aggressive than apparently the DEP is now doing with the Clean Air, or rather the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act?
I honestly, having not seen the article and knowing that, again, penalties are a routine part of our action, I don't really know where those numbers are coming from. So it's hard for me to address that, and it's not related to our specific industry. Do you have anything?
Yeah, that 9,400 is probably statewide for all the programs, not just dealing with oil and gas. I would assume
the Clean Water Act and Safe Drinking Water.
Okay, so Safe Drinking Water, that's commercial facilities where, you know, if you're buying water, if you get a water bill, somebody's selling you water, that's under the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking, clean streams violations as far as people having discharges and stuff. And there's two different things. A lot of times our inspectors will go out and they'll document, when they do their inspection report, they'll document a violation. But some of the violation, maybe the silt fence is down a little bit, but there was not a discharge. So they note that the silt, you know, we call them BMPs, best management practices. You know, they didn't have the silt fence done properly. Maybe there wasn't enough rock and stuff around the culvert pipe. There really was not an environmental harm done. But
serious contamination.
Yeah, and it's hard to address something that I'm not really sure what they're, you know, what they're referencing. You know, what. But we do, and I can just speak for my program, oil and gas, and the number of penalties that we collect here. A typical penalty probably in a $2,000 range. $200,000, that's a significant. And I know easily year after year that we're up $400,000 or $500,000 is what we end up assessing companies and penalties. So we do take action. And some of these actions too, we it's not a monetary thing on us. As far as what I was telling you, we require companies to plug a well. I mean, those aren't dollars that are coming into us. You know that the company it hurts their pocket, but the state doesn't see that money. If we need to have them restore something, that costs them tens of thousands of dollars to do it. But the state does not collect a penalty on it. I mean, we might collect a smaller amount on it, but it hurts the company a lot more than that. But the $9,400, I think someone is actually manipulating those figures. I mean, that's hard for me to believe that there's 94 violations. Maybe there was another 9,400 that they collect. They just looked at the ones that were not collected in penalties.
All right, so that was also an important question. It kind of goes on the second question. And there, Mr. Lobbins answers that the typical fine is $2,000 for an waste incident or some sort of mistake relating to the gas company. $2,000. I can't really stress how low that number is, considering how much money the gas companies are making per day, per well. You'll hear someone else make a comment about this later on, so I won't talk too much about it. This is also wanted to point out with those numbers he's referring to, I also agree that the numbers might have been looking at all of the DEP as a whole, but it is also incredibly important to show that even if there was only a small subsection of chemicals, or if there's only a small subsection of incidents relating to the oil and gas industry and oil and gas part of the DEP, that still meant that there were zero fines levied against these companies. Zero was across the board for all of the DEP. So I have a phone call here, so I'm going to start playing this audio again, and I can answer that phone call.
I do have a water question, but first I'd like to just make a suggestion. If you don't have enough employees, could you hold off the permits until you have enough employees?
Okay. I didn't say we do not have enough employees. You need to kind of ask me to give my opinion on where we kind of rank as far as, scale of 1 to 10, and we have 5. It's a new office being opened up. As far as not issuing a permit, I cannot deny a permit for not having enough staff. There's only about 5 reasons I can deny a permit. And actually, it's in that act. You can take a look at that. And those are the reasons I can deny a permit. As far as the governor would have to sign a moratorium for not issuing permits, and that's what happened up in New York. And I do not have the authority to do something like that.
Have
no, I'm not.
Isn't there some way?
And we do have enough staff. Let's be realistic about it, because these operators, they drill 24/7. Every hour of the day, 7 days a week, they're drilling. And I don't think anybody would expect an oil and gas inspector to stand on that rig at 24 hours a day. And if we did, just think how expensive that something like that would be. And there's probably, the rig count in Pennsylvania right now is probably 75. So you have 75 rigs that are operating.
and then plus our truck, you know, I just don't think that would, that would be, and I don't know if that's what somewhat, you know, expectations are, but. I think it should also be known, I think I was trying to make a point, that drilling has been going on in Pennsylvania for 150 years, and I think, and it's, most of it's in the western part of the state, and I think if anybody goes to the western part of the state, you could, I don't think you see this mass devastation that maybe a few of you think might be going on out there. It's really not occurring. Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Every well is hydrofracked, and by 99% of the wells are hydrofracked. And at the very, every well is hydrofracked. At the very, sometimes you do have a real gusher comes in, and they'll produce that maybe for a few months, half a year, until, because it'll come in naturally. But then after it comes in naturally, then a company will do the hydrofracking. The difference is the volume of water that's being used, you know, because there, you know, 10, maybe 50,000 gallons of water was used on these conventional wells, where we're talking a million. And a little bit of the difference is, on these flowbacks, you heard that you maybe hear 30% return and stuff. So if they put, you know, 3 million gallons down, they're only going to get a million back right away. But eventually they'll get a little more water back, but they'll never get everything back, because that shale is such a tight formation, it kind of holds it. But that's the big difference. And I was trying to make, you know, demonstrate that when these wells are constructed, they're designed to keep everything in the borehole. And yes, occasionally something, you know, if you drill 160,000 wells that we know of, you know, occasionally you're going to have an incident. And just like, you know, when airplanes are flying across the sky, they're built safe, occasionally you have an accident. So it's the same type of thing. I think we all heat our homes with natural gas. We put gasoline in our cars. It's a necessity, you know, and I think that's, and I think that the regulations are designed. And actually, Joyce mentioned the TAB committee, and it's actually a meeting tomorrow, and we're actually in the process of revising regulations, and we're doing some things to try to make it more protective for groundwater, and the big focus is gas migration.
One meeting I went to, it was suggested that instead of allowing the pits for the water that comes out to have tanks instead, because those liners leak. But my question really was, if our groundwater or if our aquifer is contaminated, I don't see how it would ever be clean.
All right, folks, I'm back. I kind of let you through the 2 moments of silence, and I had some comments there, but I also had an important caller call in and wanted to specify what was going on with a lot of these fines and these infractions. Many of them go towards regulating what the DEP has already set in standards. As Craig Lobbins had mentioned, there was silt fences and other things that are supposed to be there as per regulation. And many of the fines come from the companies not meeting regulation. And so that's an important to note. It's important to note that they're actually going out and finding what is wrong with the drill pads. He thought it was important to, for the audience to know that. Granted that my take on the drilling is different than his, and I am trying to show the other side of drilling, because I think personally that the drilling issue has not been given equal amount of airtime as to how good it is compared to how bad it is. And so I think it is important that there to mention the dangers and the risks associated with drilling. And I appreciate people's concerns, and I appreciate callers calling in about what they perceive as benefits to drilling. And I think we can work towards something if we can talk with each other. But I also think that it is important to have discussion from both sides. And I think there is a marked decrease or a marked deficit of airtime and information about the dangers associated with drilling. In the two clips that you just heard, the woman first asked if the DEP, considering that Mr. Lobbin said that they are a 5 out of 10 is referring to staffing and preparedness, if they would consider a moratorium on drilling, in which case Mr. Lobbin said he would not, and he would not support a moratorium in general. He also said that it is economically not feasible for the DEP and DEP officials to be observing all of the wells in the state of Pennsylvania. He mentioned something about 75 wells, and it's too much to ask the DEP to watch every single well. While I do not doubt that there are people within the DEP or in the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York, or environmental workers in general, that try incredibly hard within their job and within their capabilities to make sure that these gas industries are staying up to code and that they are trying to make sure that the people are protected. It is also important to note that people cannot be protected 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And Mr. Lobbins clearly states that there is not enough money to support regulators watching over what's going on all of this time. And it's important to note with that if you're not going to have regulators watching over all of these wells all the time, then there is not 100% guarantee that they are going to be completely safe. And it's one thing if you're talking about something not being completely safe, if it's small, minor, regarding only yourself or a small portion or a small slice of what's going on. But when you're talking about drilling thousands of feet underground and using cancer-causing and endocrine disruptors and all these chemicals that can cause blindness, irritations, lung blood disorders, deterioration of organs, it's kind of alarming to myself and to others to hear a public official say that there is no way that the DEP can monitor all of this. And I appreciate people who say that there are regulations in place and that they are trying to help. I just want to make it clear that I think it's very disturbing that there's not people there all the time making sure that this is going to be safe. I personally, if I had land or if I was in that position, that would be the only way I could be able to guarantee that my water was safe if the drilling didn't occur, but if it was occurring, if there actually was a person sitting there and watching every single movement of what was going on in the drilling rig. Because accidents, like Mr. Lobbin stated later on, accidents do happen. And so it's something that obviously it's happened in the past in Dimmock, Pennsylvania, where there's been multiple chemical spills, diesel spills. It's happened out west in Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, where there have been tainted water supplies. And I appreciate callers and people who mention that there's no way that this can happen, but it has been documented that it is happening. And while it may not happen 95% of the time, all it takes is one aquifer, one water source underground to be tainted, and that could affect tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of people. And one mistake, maybe one mistake out of 1,000, is enough to harm thousands or millions of people. And so I think it's important to understand that as it is right now, our public officials are not prepared and are kind of standing by complacent to what's going on. And I just want people to understand that we need to take a more active approach into the regulation. And like Mr. Lobbin says, we need to be personal advocates in what's going on, and we need to be the eyes and ears and make the companies accountable for their actions. So you are listening to WHRW 90.5 FM. This is The Point. I'm Vince. I forgot to mention you can call in at 607-777-2137. You can listen live at whrwfm.org. You can also instant message me if you're not one to talk on the phone at whrwmusic. That's all one word, whrwmusic. You're listening to the DEP and Penn State Extension officials talking at the Forest City High School in Forest City, Pennsylvania. They're talking about, they're answering questions about water safety and drilling regulations, and we've already heard some questions, and I kind of interrupted in the middle of a question, but I had to take a call, and I appreciate the caller calling in, and I will try to go to the beginning of the question and play that again. I hope it doesn't cause too much confusion for everyone, but I want to make sure that we hear the whole segment before you hear the answer. So let me just cue that up. Here it is. So here we go, and we'll start again.
It was suggested that instead of allowing the pits for the water that comes out to have tanks instead, because those liners leak. But my question really was, if our groundwater or if our aquifer is contaminated, I don't see how it would ever be cleaned up, and how can we have clean water? Are these companies going to supply us with fresh water from somewhere else, and for how long?
If an operator contaminates your water supply, they are responsible to restore and replace your water supply. I just heard someone say 6 months, and that's no. I don't know where that 6 months. The 6 month, maybe 6 months confusion is for presumptive liability. If they're presumed responsible, they're presumed guilty in that 6 month period if they did not do that pre-drill survey. Or if they did a pre-drill survey, then it's shown.
But my question is, how can they restore the water to its purity again if it's contaminated?
Yeah. And actually, to be honest with you, I'm not seeing that happen. And what's happening, and Brian mentioned, you have a short-term disturbance. And the reason you have a short-term disturbance is because that drill bit is actually in contact with that groundwater. So you rile it up, the dirt, you know, just like putting your, you have a dish with a little bit of sediment in the bottom, and you stir it up with a spoon, and then that sediment will just settle back out again. And that happens, and essentially that drill bit is stirring up, and it settles back out. Groundwater flows. It's a flowing system. It's just like a stream, but the difference is it crawls along at a snail's pace. So you have that disturbance, and if it does affect your water well within weeks, days actually, that water clears up again because that slug, we call it a slug, is the water's moving. You have a slug of disturbance, it moves past, and then it clears. And I know you're going to get into fracking fluids and.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, I don't care about the disturbance. I'm thinking about the contamination, real contamination.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it happen. So I mean, I think that, you know, we're worried about something that is a very rare occurrence. And yes, I said, you know, occasionally you do have something happen that you do have some, you know, this sodium and chloride, you know, elevated TDS. And that's the best indicator of this fracking stuff. And Brian had a slide up there, and it was logarithmic because he talks about the, like, salt water, because it's up in the tens, hundreds of thousands, so you do see that brine solution. And the additives that they add into it, in my experience, it's limited. It's only been the last 6 years, but I have staff that's been there for 30 years. They have not seen it. And where they do see, and you mentioned about having a hole in the pit liner, occasionally you do have, because they have that flow back going back into it. And if you have a sharp in the bottom of a pit liner, a rock pokes up through, you get some leakage, and then you end up seeing that brine water in your water supply. But again, it's a short-term disturbance because, you know, that pit is temporary. You remove the source. After they're done, they pump that water out. They encapsulate that liner. So if you did have some leakage, it's a short-term activity. And these companies, what they do as far as restore and replace, they drill new water wells or they put treatment systems in.
All right. So I hope you spelled your confusion there as to what was going on. It's important to notice here, I was personally a little bit confused and somewhat alarmed in his back and forth about there being no chemical spills or no possibility of chemical spills. He's never seen it. To then going and saying, well, there has been on occasion, but it's not been a big deal. If anyone were to read the news, to look up hydrofracturing accidents, you can find any number of these news articles and major news releases. In Dimmock, Pennsylvania is the closest one, and then Pavilion, Wyoming, in Colorado, there have been sources that have shown that it wasn't just salt water, it wasn't just brine that was getting in water, and it wasn't just total dissolved solids, it wasn't just a little bit of sediment in your water. These are people that are talking about their water with a brown black color, their water's having a foul smell, their water agitating their skin and giving them skin rashes, the water making them ill, cattle dying after they drink water. This isn't just a question of salt water, and this is where I become alarmed at the fact that the woman asked him about chemicals specifically related to hydrofracturing getting in the water. She even stated that she wasn't worried about the disturbance of the drilling, but was worried about the chemicals, and the answer was that he doesn't see it, but there is going to be salt water, and he doesn't get to the point that he doesn't answer the question of where these chemicals are going when they're going in the water. There are chemicals that you can find on the DEP's website telling you exactly what is going into the water. And there is a site, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. The Endocrine Disruption Exchange, created by Dr. Thiel Colburn, thoroughly discussing all of the chemicals used as much as they can and describing what they do to the body. And it is incredibly, incredibly alarming to see a public official saying that he thinks people are worrying and that all it is a little bit of salt water and sediment in your water. And I think it's almost to the point of offensive to tell people that they're worrying about something when there have been people just in that very area in Dimmock who have said that they can't drink the water anymore. So I think that it's important to note what is happening outside of this meeting and what has been reported compared to what is being told to us and what was being told to these people at the meeting regarding how safe the water is. I think it's just a good point to think on, as far as either they are telling us something that's not the complete truth, or they don't know what is actually going on underneath the ground and with all these chemicals. I don't know which it is. I am surprised at either answer, but I think it is a little bit misleading and insulting to just say that after all these chemicals that they can list off, that all it is a little bit of salt water that gets into your water system. With that pause, I am going to take a break to do some system checkup type stuff, and I will be playing you a nice little song by The Clash called Rebel Waltz. It's a nice little tune. So I will do that up right now, and then when I am done with that and possibly the song, we will get back to the interview. I hope everything is going well. You're listening to WHRW 90.5 FM. You can give me a call. I had a dedicated listener tell me that, like I was saying before, where he was kind of flip-flopping, Mr. Lobbins was flip-flopping, saying where he was talking about a very rare occurrence of these spills and this contamination happening, and then saying he's never seen it before. Like I was saying before about the flip-flop, where on one hand he's saying it doesn't happen, And then on the other hand, he was saying, well, it has happened, but I wouldn't worry about it. And just saying that people are worrying and kind of putting them off as people who are needlessly worrying about something, like something that's not important. So I appreciate the dedicated response from the internet person. So I will be playing the song, and I hope you all enjoy. All right, folks, we're back. I got to do a few station announcements, and then we'll get back to the interview. I don't know if we'll be able to finish the whole thing, but I will try to shorten up what I have to say so that we can hear all of the questions. I think it's important to hear other people talking about the issue that they're concerned about and bringing up good points. It sheds more of a light onto the how many people this is affecting and how it's affecting them. And it's not just coming from one person who is could be ranting at you, but coming from many people who have legitimate concerns about their health and about their well-being and about the well-being of their neighbors in the world. So important. So here we go.
I am not quite certain who to address this to, but I believe, could be wrong, I've been wrong quite often lately, that the gas companies had an option that they can remove the steel casing from our wells and just leave them with the cement casing. If in fact it's true, how long is the cement casing going to be stable in order to protect our water sources?
And removal being when the well is still productive, or removal after they've...
I'm not certain. Yeah. I just understand.
Okay. When they decommission a well, when the well has expired, they're required to cement it. And what they're doing is cementing off that producing formation. So they do remove the steel at that time. They're removing that production pipe, and now they go back down in the hole on top of where the producing formation is, and they set a cement plug. And every producing formation is required to set a cement plug in that. But what they do, they clean out the well so they have a good cement job. So that's, you know, yeah, doing an active well as far as removing casing, that's the only reason they would do that if they're doing some type of repair. If like the well, you know, because some of these wells could be 50 years old, so sometimes they'll go back in and they'll remove casing, put good steel back in the well and back into production.
Is the concrete casing still in place? Because if in fact that is, that leaches caustic and toxic materials.
Yeah, it shouldn't leak toxic materials. I mean, the concrete, it sets up hard. I mean, the concrete...
It decomposes, too.
It can weather, but, you know...
Also, low-level radioactive waste is recycled into cement as part of the EPA's recycling program. How do you defend water and aquifers from that decomposing
concrete or cement?
Concrete that's releasing radioactive ions.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm not sure what kind of radioactive ions that concrete would have in it. Maybe you're kind of mixing up with, they call it NORM, it's natural occurring radioactive material.
I'm talking about hazardous waste, radioactive waste from nuclear power plants and nuclear.
Okay. Next question, please. Yes.
All right, so that was also a really good question. I wanted to quickly point out that personally I found it I was very alarmed that the DEP official knew nothing about concrete and about the materials that go into concrete and how concrete degrades or how it performs under stress and how it performs over the course of time. And I'm not claiming that he was necessarily lying or misleading. I just find it that the person who has been a geologist for so long and who is in a position of not necessarily power, but he oversees what these drilling companies are doing. And it would seem to me that it would be important to understand all of the concepts behind a thing like concrete, where concrete plays such an integral role in the safety and the regulation of these drilling pads and these drilling holes. That also seemed to be a major reason for the spill in Dimock was a concrete casing that was not drilled too deeply and the gas was able to escape. So it is something where if something like concrete is so integral to the process of drilling, it would seem to me that an understanding of everything about concrete, how it acts under pressure, how it acts next to brine water, what kind of chemicals are released by it when it is sitting in water, would be an important it would be an important thing to understand everything relating to it. It's seems to me it would sort of go along with his job description, would be understanding all of the and processes completely of what's going on, and that would better serve him to regulate and to make sure things are up to code. You can't regulate something if you have no idea what it is you're regulating. So I just wanted to point that out, and we'll continue.
I recall it's your office that issues permits for these drillings.
That's correct.
And you've issued quite a few lately.
Yes, we have.
Now, Jennifer, is it Jennifer's job then? You get some sort of a statement from the drillers as to how what their water, I forget the term you use, water plan is, I wrote it down, but I can't read my own writing.
A water management plan, that's...
Water management, what does that mean?
That's where they're going to get the water that they use in the drilling and fracking process.
Okay. And now what about disposal of that 20, 30, 40% of the water that comes back to the surface?
Yeah, they're required to dispose of that at a facility that can take it. It might be a sewage treatment plant, it might be a brine treatment plant, and they have to do all the... reporting requirements and monitoring that's required by our waste management program for residual waste.
Now, Craig, you've issued how many permits, I'd say, in the last 6 months?
This year, I think, I just looked at this number, 2,000, I'm going to say 2,000.
2,000
Well,
permits.
Probably a little more than that, actually.
And how many of them are drilling now? I just want this for my own information.
Yeah, I'd say probably half of those have probably been drilled this year. Half. Yeah, and I just want to follow up on that. And a permit condition we put in for Marcellus wells that they have to have a, so when the operator gets a permit, they have to have this water management plan, they have to have this control disposal plan, and on that control disposal plan, they actually characterize the waste before they haul it off. And the way that they actually track it, there's a tracking process. And it is essentially three different people handle that waste. It's the operator, because he's generating it. The truck comes and picks it up. He has it. He documents it. And then the third person that has that same waste stream is the treatment facility. So we have record on where that waste is going. And that's something new that we've actually just implemented about a year ago.
Yeah, I could ask a lot more questions on that, but drainage won't permit it. But we're issuing permits. Do we have the disposal information at the same time? Because I'm concerned that we might be issuing permits not knowing where the wastewater is going. Now, Brian hasn't spoken much about the chemicals that are in this fracking mixture. How is that removed from the system? Are these treatment plants doing reverse osmosis or high pressure osmosis?
No. And the state realized that's where the bottleneck is, because there's going to be millions of gallons of new wastewater out there, and when we realize that TDS is a tough thing to treat, and really the way you treat for TDS is reverse osmosis that you mentioned. Or else you do crystallization. Crystallization, essentially, you have a, you, I'm going to say you boil it, boil it, and what you have left, the vapors go off, and what you have left is a solid, and then that solid you dispose.
But as far as you know, no, excuse me for interrupting, yes. But as far as you know, the treatment plants aren't doing that.
No,
I would guess that's a long process.
Yeah, yes, and what the treatment plants are doing, they have a permit. They have a permit. Most permits are valid for 5 years, no longer than 5 years. And the state has a strategy in 2011 where they're changing the TDS numbers, and it's probably some of the other things too, but TDS is one. And we're going to have it. We have a strategy of it that they cannot exceed the 500, because the 500 is what we figure is a water quality standard. And the way they, what they're doing right now, the treatment facilities have a permit, and they're allowed certain quality of water to come out of the pipe. They cannot exceed that. So that is monitored on a monthly basis, and actually on a weekly basis. So as long as they're not going that exceed, as long as they're meeting their current permit, then they're in compliance. But in 2011, the state is changing that, and you cannot change that overnight. You know, they are not in violation with their existing permit, but we're gonna tightly ratchet it down. We're gonna have more requirements in 2011.
You don't have. You said yourself, you're understaffed. You cannot have a person on site every day at every drilling site, correct?
That's correct.
How do you know they're sending this water to a treatment plant?
Because there's a good tracking process. We have a good tracking process in place now, because three different parties have. I guess the operator could be just dumping it on site. And trying to get rid of it that way, but if he's not doing that, then he's going to have to buddy up with whoever the trucker is. Now the trucker, you know, he's going to, you know, maybe they got some little side deal going on, but we're tracking that. So everyone that touches that wastewater, you know, is a responsibility. Sure, there's some things that could slip through the cracks, but we, you know, and other than watching, having somebody that sits, you know, one of our employees sitting with a. On site with that truck driver, you know, 24/7.
It's a public health issue, and I'm very concerned that Ryan. We're spending all this time trying. How can we protect ourselves against the drills? And I realize you can't make policy. Why isn't it the other way around? We have food on the market or drugs. The drug companies, the food companies have to prove that it's safe. These growers are not proving it's safe. So we're really dependent on you.
Yeah. And you be your own advocate, and more eyes in the woods, you know, essentially you all live in this area, and if you see some truck pulling in the woods, and that's the only way, you know, if you think there's some illegal disposal going.
A little more control than that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, so I think that was one of the best questions that was asked, or best series of questions that was asked, and I think it was able to elicit answers that weren't necessarily helpful, but kind of showed where the DEP is standing and where officials are coming from in this. First off, I find it, once again, confusing how at first it's saying that a little disturbance of TDS in your water or a little bit of salt water is not really an issue as it will pass, but then saying that referring to this water as wastewater and then having to take it to a waste treatment facility. It seems at one point that it's a minor issue that will just pass. A little bit of TDS in your water, a little bit of sediment in your water will go away. However, we have to take this water to a waste treatment facility where it is considered a hazardous waste. Also with that, the line of people that are involved with this waste, none of this is necessarily overseen by the EP or by the DEP. I'm sorry. The DEP has people document what's going on, but once again, it's up to the company that is, or the companies involved in the waste disposal, to make sure these records are up to date. This is a big problem in any industry when you leave the safety up to the company to decide how they want to document what's safe and what they're doing and what they're not doing. A point that was made from a long distance friend was that the regulations for the permits, a permit means that the state is giving the company permission to haul around hazardous waste without our water treatment plans being able to properly treat the water, wastewater. Permission is granted by the state, not by the people. Meaning that there is the department, the oil and gas department, most likely, that is overseeing these regulations. And like Mr. Lobbins just stated here just recently, he gave out 2,000 permits this past year. 2,000 permits. That's a lot of work that he's doing every year, and that's just permits. That's not relating to all the regulations regarding water and all of that and the hazardous waste. And so I think it is incredibly important to note that there's so much work that he has to do. How do we feel safe? Do you feel safe trusting that a overworked, overburdened group of department of the government who have stated just in this interview that they are not even fully staffed and fully prepared, do we trust that they are making sure that all of these permits and regulations are being followed through and are being carried out as per regulation? And do we feel safe knowing that these regulations are being given to companies that will follow them? So that's just a point there. And I think that the final thing that Mr. Lobbins said, which was incredibly important, that I want to discuss, is that we should be our personal advocates and we should be the eyes and the ears on the ground, and we should be responsible for ourselves. And while it may seem like sort of a brush off as to the government not taking care and not taking responsibility for its actions, I think it's also important that it is a call to civilians, citizens, people interested and people affected by this to take matters into their own hands. And we can't sit around and wait for organizations like the DEP or for companies to make sure that we're going to be safe. We have to form groups. We have to form, we have to have meetings. We have to get involved. We have to be on site looking and taking videos, taking cameras, taking film, and documenting what's going on here. It's incredibly important that we take matters into our own hands. In the end, from what the DEP official, Mr. Lobbins, is saying, we're responsible for ourselves at this point. The DEP can't regulate everything. It's physically impossible to, considering the amount of work that they're doing and how understaffed they are or how not prepared they are for all of this work. And not only are they not prepared, but it also seems to me that they either are uneducated about what is going on or are misleading and spreading confusion about what is happening, whether this is wastewater that needs to be treated, whether it's just a little disturbance in our watershed, whether it's going to pass, is it coming from drilling, are these chemicals, why are these chemicals, there are chemicals going in, why is it just salt coming out, why, where is all of the, there's no flow into what they're saying, and there's no rhythm as to their responses and to their answers to these questions. So I just want to stress that it's important that if you're in New York and drilling is about to happen near you, that you take a very active role into what's going on around you, and that you don't let a government organization or the company assure you that what is safe is safe, and that we should trust the company and the government to make sure that things remain safe. And if you see anything that's wrong, you should be the first person out there documenting it and getting other people aware of what's going on. So back to the interview.
Good evening. I live in Pike County, and I'd like to thank you for coming this evening. And I noticed from the map that there are two drill sites in Wayne County. Can you tell me, Jennifer, where they are and how they're disposing of their wastewater?
Yeah, those are
I think they're just permits issued and paying. Go ahead.
Steve is one of our oil and gas inspectors. Okay. Works out of the Wilkes-Barre office.
They have drilled.
In Beach Lake?
No, they've drilled one well up near, maybe it is Beach Lake. Just outside of Holmesdale?
Yes.
The Robeson well.
Torrey.
Okay, that's I know it by the farm name, so I know it as the Robeson well. That well has been drilled, has not been fracked. It's just been drilled and cemented, and actually it was drilled and then it was plugged. There's cement plugs in there in that hole right now at three different depths.
Well, what is their plan for disposing of the wastewater once that process starts?
They would have to get permits and...
There have been no permits issued for that?
I don't think they've even... They don't have any permits from the DRBC, if I know, for even withdrawals, and that's the big holdup.
In order to do the hydrofracking, they need to get approval from the DRBC, and they have not received that yet. So once they get that approval, then they would have a waste control plan, is what we call it, for essentially where they're going to take the waste stream. So after they do that, they're fracking, and then they tell us we're going to take it. But they're not allowed to do that until they get DRBC's approval, then our approval.
And is DRBC withholding approval because of the moratorium in New York State?
I cannot answer that for them.
No. All right. And also, the $200,000 fine that you mentioned, don't you think this is very low in an industry that's going to make millions and millions of dollars, when small communities and private homeowners, if they violate, are hit with some very heavy fines? This doesn't seem to be. I mean, if I were making that much money, sometimes it would be better to pay the fine than go to the expense of complying with all of the regulations.
Right. Okay, first I got to mention that those were not Marcellus wells. And to me, a $200,000 fine is a pretty significant fine. And actually, this company was out of business for 2 months. And when I say out of business, they were not allowed to do any more drilling, fracking, building sites. And they had to go back in and for that two-month period clean up their mess. And it didn't take them 2 months to clean it up. But it took that long for us to negotiate a deal on. And essentially, what we're doing, we're managing the number of sites they're allowed to have operating at one time. So we're limiting, after you do 10, we'll come out and inspect your 10, and then we'll give you 10 more. And that's how we crafted that. So we're helping them trying to manage their sites. And the first thing that one of the slides I showed you was the purpose of the act. And part of our charge is for the development of oil and gas. So we cannot just say companies you can no longer drill in Pennsylvania. They have a right to. And so we try to strike a balance, what's fair to them and then what's fair to you. And the rest of those purposes too, to protect your property rights, to protect the environment, and to make it safe for the people that are operating those drill rigs and stuff. So we have to strike a balance, and that's
Thank you.
All right. So you just heard another question there. I have a quick response about that. First of all, coming from the previous question, I also wanted to state that he mentioned that the TDS levels are being, that companies are all meeting TDS levels, but at the same time, they're going to be strengthening those TDS levels in 2 years. This may also be something to look into as far as if the TDS levels, why are they being strengthened in 2 years? And if they need to be strengthened in 2 years, what is going on now that is causing them to be strengthened? Is waiting 2 years really an option as far as health and the environment is concerned? Is 2 years of these increased TDS levels going to be safe? And then back to this second question. First of all, the question about fines, like many of the speakers have done here, they have either completely ignored the question or answered the question the way they thought the question should be or the way they thought the question was, and not necessarily addressing the exact question. He thought the fines were good enough, but doesn't seem to consider that the lady was saying that, considering they make so many billions of dollars, that wouldn't it be more feasible for them to pay a few thousand dollars or $200,000 at the most instead of following regulations? And Mr. Lobbins stated that he thought $200,000 was a big fine. And he was putting it in personal perspective, as far as $200,000 seems big to him, but was not necessarily talking about $200,000 being big for a corporation. Maybe he was, and maybe he thought $200,000 was big for a corporation. In that case, I think he's also uneducated about how much these corporations are making per day off a drill well, or doesn't really like to look at things that way. Also, he talked about a $200,000 fine. That was the fine that went to U.S. Energy after they had shut down. That was not a typical fine. So if considering that they make $400,000 a year from fines and $200,000 is a big fine, you have to take into account that most of the fines and most of these incidents are small $2,000, $10,000 fines that are happening to these corporations. So that's just a point I wanted to make. And just wanted to point out that about the TDS, and how also that I think it's kind of disturbing to hear about the companies having every right to drill, and how it's going to strike a fair balance between companies who make billions of dollars every year on extracting gas and then landowners who make mere thousands of dollars and have the potential of their water being destroyed and their lives being destroyed in return for this. I don't think that's a fair balance, but that's just my personal opinion of that matter. So we'll continue. I have about enough time for about one more interview, and then I'll leave you with a little bit of a tune that might wake you up a little bit, and then the next DJ will be on. So here is the last interview I think I'll be able to get in.
Hi, I want to also thank you for coming, and I'm sorry I interrupted, but I get really frustrated with the hydrofracking issue because, and this really isn't my question, but there's a difference between hydrofracking and the kind of hydrofracking they're going to do in the Marcellus. Is that true?
I think the biggest difference is the volume of water. And probably the main additive that they're adding is a surfactant. A lot of times you might have heard slick water. And what it is a friction reducer, because they're moving a lot of water and a lot of sand down that borehole extremely fast. And what they want to do is eliminate as much friction or drag as possible when they're doing that. So essentially, it's a soap, a surfactant. It's a soap. It's a soap. That's really what it is. And there are some other things to add in, and Brian mentioned that, because they want to keep the formation clean. And clean by they don't want iron to build up, they don't want to have a bacteria down in there, so they add some of those other additives, and they're at small amounts, and most of them actually have a very short half-life or lifespan, because when they take that water out now, they take it to a treatment plant. That treatment plant has to make sure that he's not putting some type of a bactericide or something in the stream, because it's going to end up killing the aquatic life and fish and all that kind of stuff. So they have a chemistry where it has a very short lifespan, so those inhibitors are essentially gone. By the time it gets to the treatment plant, they're gone, you know, as far as bacteria and that kind of stuff. So and those are at small quantities. So the big difference is the amount of water that they're using.
But when it's said that there's a lot of experience with hydrofracking, is there not a lot of experience with this type that they're using in the Marcellus?
I'm not an expert in that field, but I think really the big thing is the volume of water. A lot of times, instead of using water, sometimes I use foam and these like non-conventional things that they can do a number of different things in a frac. They can use like liquid nitrogen, and essentially, you know, that's an additive that they use, or they can use this foam instead of the water or the water. But as far as I know, these Marcellus wells are using water. So they've been doing this hydrofracking for decades, and just, you know,
this is a new process.
Yes, the Marcellus
that they're using here in the Marcellus shale. A new untested process.
Yes, it is. Yes, I guess because it's just the volume. And why I say yes, it's the volume of water, and plus it's a shale too. So we
don't have a lot of history about what the outcome will be.
Not with the Marcellus. No, that's correct.
Because that's really what we here are concerned about, is the Marcellus hydrofracking, not the older type of hydrofracking.
Another comparable formation that's in Texas is the Barnett Shale, and they have about 15 years of history there. And then if you maybe do a little bit of research or take a look at that and see if any of those communities have experienced problems with the hydrofracking.
Have you done any research on that?
I have not.
I have done a lot, and I've had a lot of problems.
With the hydrofracking?
Yes.
And what kind?
In the Barnett. Water problems. Earthquakes is something I've had problems with.
Yeah, I've read that the stuff on the earthquakes. But
anyway, my question...
All right, folks. That's the... I'm going to have to cut off the interview there. I'm going to kind of... Oh, that's fine. Oh, it looks like I have a little bit more time. It was a good time for me to stop anyway, and just kind of, I wanted to talk a little bit about that question that was being asked and then kind of leave you all with something. So that was a good point to make right at the end. First of all, many people are saying that the gas drilling has been going, let's start from the beginning. Many people have been saying gas drilling has been going on for 150 years. Yes, gas drilling has been going on, but hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling has not been going on for this long. Hydrofracturing has been going on since the 1950s. And moreover than that, since they found the Marcellus Shale, the type of drilling that's going on with the Marcellus Shale and hydrofracturing is much different than what they have used in hydrofracturing in the past. They use hydrofracturing in vertical drills as well, but this is going into horizontal wells where it can shoot across a mile underground in any direction. So the amount of land that you're affecting greatly increases. So it's important to note that the companies and officials will try to spin this idea that there is a long history of drilling and that there is much research and practice that went into this drilling, and so it's a perfected technique, when in fact this slick water, this Marcellus drilling has been going on for maybe 15 years at the most. And in the Marcellus, it's been going on for maybe 5 years. So I wanted to point that out and kind of give you an idea that this has not been going on for a very long time, and they don't have much, if any, sort of idea what to expect, what kind of outcomes, good or bad, to expect from this. And so I think it's important to understand that our officials aren't necessarily knowledgeable, and nor is anyone really knowledgeable what's going on. It's like many new technologies or prescription pills or anything like that, where oftentimes there is a lag between the technology and what it can do and finding out all the side effects that come from it. So the real alarm comes from the fact that this is such a huge operation that affects so many people and affects so many things, environment, water supply, health, on such a big level that it is very scary to just put out a new technology like this that can affect so many people without understanding completely what's going on. And so I think that that was a good point by the speaker here. And so that was about as much of the interview as we're going to be able to play. I don't want to get into more questions before, because we definitely are running out of time, and I don't want to get in halfway into a question and cut you all off. So I may play the other part of that interview on the next show, although I'm sure to have much more sound and footage from recent interviews and spills from around the area. So I hope you join me next time at next Tuesday from 11:30 in the morning until 1 p.m. in the afternoon. You're listening to The Point. This is Vince. Are you ready to go on soonish? Okay, so I'll just cue up a song here and kind of play that, and so that he can the next DJ can come on. Sorry, what's your show? And the MC's coming on your show? Fine Cart. Fine Cart Radio is his show, and so you'll be hearing him in the next few minutes. So I have a nice little treat for y'all, one of my personal favorites, so I hope you enjoy.